Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Dorothy Gundy, and Susan Shand. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
President Donald Trump has called for arming teachers as a way to stop school shootings. His comments came after the deadly school shooting in Parkland, Florida, on February 14th. A 19-year-old gunman killed 17 students and teachers at Stoneman Douglas High School. The shooter used an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle that was bought legally. Since the shooting, Trump has also suggested he may support some new measures to limit guns. One measure would ban anyone under 21 years old from buying a firearm. Another would aim to make it harder for mentally ill people to buy a gun. Trump took to Twitter to explain his reasoning for wanting to arm teachers. History shows that a school shooting lasts, on average, 3 minutes. It takes police and first responders approximately 5 to 8 minutes to get to the site of crime. Highly trained, gun-adept teachers, coaches, would solve the problem instantly, before police arrive. Great deterrent. Last week, Trump met at the White House with survivors of the Parkland shooting, as well as state and local officials from Florida, to discuss school safety.
I think we need hardened sights. We need to let people know, you come into our schools, you're going to be dead, and it's going to be fast.
Trump's proposal to train some teachers to be armed in the classroom was criticized by organizations representing teachers. The National Education Association, or NEA, represents 3 million educators working at U.S. public schools and colleges. Becky Pringle is vice president of the NEA. She is also an eighth grade science teacher.
I just cringed when I heard the president's proposal, as did so many educators across this country. I tried to imagine having the responsibility of teaching these children the wonders of science and being held responsible for making life and death decisions with a loaded firearm.
The American Federation of Teachers, which says it represents 1.7 million teachers, also criticized the plan. It said the clear message from its membership, even those who own guns, was that educators don't want to be armed. They want to teach. The superintendent of Broward County Public Schools, the district where the shooting happened, said he is totally against arming teachers. Robert Runcie said educators already have a difficult job, and giving them weapons would just make it harder. Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott has also said he opposes the idea of giving guns to teachers. But he did call for increased security at schools, including a plan to put a trained police officer in every Florida school by the start of the fall 2018 school year.
Pringle says she understands the concerns of officials and parents who want to make schools more secure. But she says the NEA supports common sense gun reform to help prevent mass shootings. She says Trump and other elected officials who favor armed teachers have not spent enough time with educators and students.
So this is what we're doing, and this is what we wish the president would do and others in positions of power would do, and that is listen to our students. That's what we're doing. We're listening to our students, and they are rising up, and they're not backing down, and they're being very clear about what will make them feel safer in school.
Pringle was talking about student activists in Florida and other states who have responded to the shooting by holding protests and demanding stronger gun laws. One of those students is Sofia Hidalgo, a 15-year-old student at Albert Einstein High School in the state of Maryland. She joined a demonstration last week in front of the White House. She says the young activists realize that the same kind of tragic shooting could also happen at their schools.
I think that once we realized that this could happen to us as well, that it was time for us to make our voices heard to ensure that it never happens again, because this is a serious tragedy.
Hidalgo says her school has armed police officers, and this makes her feel safer. The school also carries out drills to practice how to react to violence and other serious situations. But she does not think arming teachers would help solve the problem.
By arming the teachers, you're just distributing even more guns, and this is not the solution that we need. We need to be restricting the sales of guns, not increasing them. And by arming the teachers, you're trying to fight fire with fire, and that's not a solution.
Several U.S. states already allow teachers to be armed in schools. One of them is Texas. Steve Clugston is the superintendent of Kalispell Independent School District in Kalispell, Texas. He says one reason the district decided to allow armed teachers was because the area does not have its own police department. This is the case in dozens of school districts in small communities across Texas. If a shooting happens in these areas, Clugston says, police officers likely could not reach the school quickly enough. Armed teachers must first have a license to carry a handgun in Texas. Educators in the Kalispell district receive training from experts in shooting and gun safety. They also complete drills in the schools on how to react to a variety of live shooter situations. As he sees it, Clugston said school violence is no different than a situation in which a family is being attacked inside their home.
And somebody's trying to kick in that door and threatening to kill everybody in that room. At that particular moment, there's not many people that don't wish they had a gun to protect themselves at that particular time.
Clugston says he believes arming teachers works as a deterrent to violence by sending a clear message to would-be attackers. His district places large signs in front of all its school buildings warning that armed teachers and employees are on the property.
We're going to, you know, use whatever force is necessary to protect our people. When you look at a lot of these active shooters, they tend to target that soft target. We're going to let them know we're not a soft target.
Clugston says the reaction to the district's program from parents and community members has been 100% positive. In the Parkland, Florida attack, suspected shooter Nicholas Cruz was a former student known by school officials to have a troubled past. The school safety debate has also centered on ways to identify students who could be at risk for future violent behavior.
One group seeking to make a difference is the not-for-profit Educators School Safety Network. It offers safety training programs aimed at preventing school violence. Amanda Klinger is director of operations for the organization. She says the group also provides educators with tools to identify, assess, and manage certain students who may pose a threat.
This is something educators are asking for. Educators aren't asking to be armed with guns, but they are asking to be armed with education and training and the empowerment to be able to do some of these things to keep the kids safe in their schools.
She added that teachers are often the best people to identify students that could become threats. But many lack the needed skills and tools to effectively do this.
We have a fact-based investigative approach where you have a multidisciplinary threat assessment team, and they're looking at who should we be concerned about, how concerned should we be, and then what are we going to do about it?
Klinger says her group attempts to arm teachers with the tools to recognize signs of trouble early on, before students begin showing violent behavior. This way, teachers and administrators can decide on the best intervention to prevent future tragedies. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
American John Peck lost his arms and legs in an explosion in Afghanistan in 2010. But unlike others who suffer such a loss, Peck does not have prosthetic arms. Doctors instead performed a successful double arm transplant operation on Peck. The retired Marine Corps sergeant is now learning to use his replacement arms at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Maryland. As Peck learns to use his new arms, he thinks about the family that donated the arms of their dead son.
You know, the first few minutes I was happy, but then I started to think about, you know, my emotions kind of changed, and it changed to the point where I was upset. Like, I was, you know, I knew that somebody died, and it wasn't about me at that minute. It was about the individual that lost their lives.
Transplant operations are not new, and many patients are helped by transplanted organs. John Peck says his situation is different.
So like an organ transplant, it's different. Like they can't see inside of their body, but every day I look down, I'm like, ah, hey, this is somebody else's hand, or, you know, this is somebody else's elbow that I'm moving back and forth. But I don't see it as, you know, it's weird. It's just part of my norm now.
Peck wore prosthetics before doctors gave him the replacement arms. The change has been hard, but physical therapists like Anne-Marie Orr say he is making progress.
John and I have been working together for about, what is it, John, a year and a half. And so the progress has been huge. I mean, with just in terms of range of motion in his arms, in terms of his strength and his ability, again, to be more independent with his day-to-day activities.
Physical therapy assistant Alyssa Olson is also working with Peck.
In the time that we've started working together, we're pushing to progressing to use his hands more and more and more, and he's getting function back.
At Walter Reed, there are many patients who have lost their arms or legs on the battlefield. Most receive prosthetics. But Peck agreed to try the transplant. Not everyone thinks transplants are a good idea because of the possibility that the body may reject another person's limb. Patients like Peck must take up to 30 pills a day to stay healthy and stop medical complications.
It was worth it. It was worth it to me. I have goals. I want to be independent. I want to be able to do things for myself.
The operation took 16 hours and involved nearly 60 doctors and medical specialists. It has given John Peck a new life. I'm Susan Shand.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By February 1st, 1861, 7 southern states had withdrawn from the United States of America. They created their own independent nation, the Confederate States of America. The South seceded because Abraham Lincoln, a Republican, had been elected president. Southerners believed he would support a constitutional ban on slavery. They were afraid their way of life would soon end. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe discuss the beginning of Abraham Lincoln's presidency.
President-elect Lincoln traveled by train from his home in Illinois to Washington, D.C. Along the way, he stopped to make speeches. As he got closer to Washington, he was warned that a mob was planning to attack the train. He had to continue his trip in secret. Lincoln arrived in Washington 9 days before his inauguration. It was a busy time. He talked with many people, including delegates to a peace convention. Every state was represented at the convention, except the states that had seceded. The delegates urged Lincoln to support slavery. They urged him not to go to war over the issue. Lincoln said only that he would faithfully execute the duties of president of all the United States. He said he would protect and defend the American Constitution.
While Lincoln waited for Inauguration Day, he chose the members of his cabinet. He wanted men representing all opposing groups in the Republican Party. He hoped this would unite the party and give him support in the difficult years ahead. Lincoln chose William Seward as Secretary of State, Salmon Chase as Treasury Secretary, Gideon Welles as Navy Secretary, and Montgomery Blair as Postmaster General. Seward did not like Chase, Welles, or Blair. He told Lincoln that he could not serve in the cabinet with them. He said they would never be able to work together. Lincoln answered that he would be happy to make Seward ambassador to Britain instead of Secretary of State. Seward gave up the argument and agreed to join the cabinet.
Inauguration Day was the 4th of March. President-elect Lincoln rode to the ceremony with outgoing President James Buchanan. Buchanan was ready to give up his power. He told Lincoln, "If you are as happy to get into the White House as I am to get out of it, you must be the happiest man alive." The inaugural ceremony took place outside the Capitol building. Lincoln was to give his inaugural speech before being sworn in. He had worked hard on the speech. He wanted to say clearly what his policy would be on slavery and secession. These were the issues which divided the country. These were the issues which were leading the country to civil war. This is what Lincoln said.
"There seems to be some fear among the people of the southern states that because a Republican administration is coming to power, their property and their peace and personal security are threatened. There has never been any reasonable cause for such fears. In fact, much evidence to the contrary has existed, open to their inspection. It is found in nearly all my published speeches. In one of those speeches, I declared that I had no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I said I believed I had no legal right to do so, and no wish to do so. This statement is still true. I can only say that the property, peace, and security of no part of the country are to be in any way endangered by the incoming administration."
Lincoln noted that 72 years had passed since the first president was inaugurated. "Since then," he said, 15 men had led the nation through many dangers, generally with great success." He went on,
"I now begin the same job under great difficulty. The breaking up of the Federal Union, before only threatened, now is attempted. I believe that under universal law and the Constitution, the union of these states is permanent. This is shown by the history of the Union itself. The Union is much older than the Constitution. It was formed, in fact, by the Articles of Association in 1774. It was continued by the Declaration of Independence in 1776. It grew further under the Articles of Confederation in 1778. And finally, in 1787, one of the declared reasons for establishing the Constitution of the United States was to form a more perfect union. I therefore believe that, in view of the Constitution and the laws, the union is not broken. I shall make sure, as the Constitution orders me to do, that the laws of the union are obeyed in all the states. In doing this, there needs to be no bloodshed or violence. and there shall be none, unless it be forced upon the national government. The power given to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the taxes. But beyond what is necessary for these purposes, there will be no invasion, no using of force against or among the people anywhere.
Lincoln then repeated some statements he had made during his campaign for president. He used them to explain the differences between North and South. One part of the country, he said, believes slavery is right and should be extended. The other part believes slavery is wrong and should not be extended. This, he said, was the only important dispute. Lincoln admitted that even if the dispute could be settled peacefully, there were those who wanted to see the Union destroyed. He said his words were not meant for them. They were meant only for those people who really loved the Union. He said,
"Physically speaking, we cannot separate. We cannot remove our sections from each other, nor build an impassable wall between them. A husband and wife may be divorced and go away from or out of the reach of each other. But the different parts of our country cannot do this. They must remain face to face, and relations, friendly or hostile, must continue between them. Is it possible to make those relations better after separation than before? Can aliens make treaties easier than friends can make laws? Can treaties be more faithfully enforced between aliens than laws can be enforced among friends? My countrymen, one and all, think calmly and well upon this subject. Nothing valuable can be lost by taking time. In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the great issue of civil war. The government will not attack you. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though emotion may have damaged them, it must not break our ties of love."
Abraham Lincoln then placed his hand on the Christian holy book, the Bible. The Chief Justice of the United States then spoke the presidential oath. Lincoln repeated the words, and the United States had a new president. Lincoln's first crisis came quickly. It was a problem left unsolved by the outgoing president. Lincoln had to decide immediately what to do about the federal fort in the harbor of Charleston, South Carolina, Fort Sumter. The fort was surrounded by Southern artillery. Southern gunboats guarded the harbor. The federal troops inside Fort Sumter were getting dangerously low on food. But any attempt to send more men or supplies would be seen as an act of war, civil war.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.